I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection. The nickname is SARS. It stands for Severe Acute Respiratory Syndrome. Whatever you call it, the World Health Organization's now calling it the most significant outbreak in history to be spread through air travel. Hundreds of people in Hong Kong are now confined to an apartment building by armed guards, and there's talk of a full quarantine for the city itself. Two hospitals in Canada are closed. There are now 59 cases confirmed in the United States, and new ones appearing in places like Belgium, Ireland, and Australia. What's frightening about this pneumonia-like disease is not how many people are dying. In fact, more than 90% of the people who get it survive. But most of the people who've been infected so far are medical personnel. The epidemiologist who identified SARS died 3 days ago. More than half the employees at the French hospital in Hanoi are infected. Doctors in Singapore are reported to be wearing germ warfare suits. Connection listeners, how well prepared is this country to deal with SARS or an epidemic like it? Are the recent preparations for bioterror defense any use at all? Our number is 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We'll be speaking with an expert on public health and epidemiology shortly. We're going first to Hong Kong. Keith Bradshaw is bureau chief there for the New York Times. He says the concern over this epidemic is growing minute to minute.
Yes, and the situation just keeps getting worse. In the last 2 hours, there have been they've announced the daily totals again. Another 52 cases at that apartment block, another 23 cases elsewhere in the city. It's a real mystery why more than 250 people in that apartment block have become ill. There are concerns that perhaps it's possible that the virus is transmitted not just by people coughing or sneezing on each other, but maybe if you cough or sneeze on a surface and it becomes contaminated, maybe the elevators there became contaminated. There are also concerns that maybe it's being transmitted through the water or the air at that complex. But whatever it is, it's just caused tremendous concern. Even in the hours since I wrote that story, we've had panic buying in the supermarkets here today. The government appealed for calm several hours ago, but you have people filling their grocery carts with rice and other essentials here. There was an apparently false rumor this afternoon that drove down the stock market and created some concern in the currency markets about whether Hong Kong would be quarantined. The government has emphatically denied that, but certainly there is concern here.
Tell me what else you'll see in the city. I gather that schools are closed, offices are closed. Are people in the streets wearing these paper masks?
The schools are closed all week through Sunday. Most of the offices are open. However, quite a few people have been encouraged by their companies to work from home. There are very few people in the restaurants, not so many people in the hotels. The streets are much less populated than they would have been a week or 2 weeks ago. The proportion of people wearing masks varies depending on the setting. If you're out on one of the few less busy roads, then maybe half the people are wearing masks. On the other hand, if you're riding the subway or something, then most of the people are wearing masks. The subway and the buses are now handing out free masks. All the taxi drivers, bus drivers, subway attendants and so forth all wear masks. A lot of people are not just wearing paper masks. They're wearing some of the more elaborate respirators and so forth. But overall, I think that the city has been trying to keep people calm, and many people are, but there have been a few areas of concern.
Keith, what about you when you're doing your job? Are you wearing a mask? Are you concerned about your own safety?
I am absolutely going to press conferences with a mask on. You've got journalists and government officials alike who have been in the pneumonia wards with direct exposure to patients, and in many countries, all of these people would now be quarantined. Hong Kong has decided not to quarantine anything near as many people or as wide a range of people as in other countries. In Hong Kong, basically, only immediate family members of victims are being quarantined, and everybody else, including social contacts of victims, has not been quarantined. So I am wearing a mask to go to press conferences. I'm not wearing a mask to go for a walk down a road with not that many people on it outside the immediate downtown area, because if you're in an open space, you're probably not going to get the concentration of viral particles that you're really going to worry about it.
Keith, thanks so much for doing this.
Okay, well, thank you. It's my pleasure.
Keith Bradshaw is the New York Times bureau chief in Hong Kong. Since I spoke to him earlier this morning, the city has announced a plan to move infected people from that sealed apartment complex to quarantine camps, though nothing has been started on that. Let's hear from Canada next. Jan Wong is a columnist and senior reporter with Canada's national newspaper, The Globe and Mail. She's joining us on the line from Toronto. Hello, Jan.
Hi.
I gather that the number of cases of SARS in Canada is somewhere up around 129 this morning. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. That's the latest we have, but the number changes all the time. Every hour it's changing.
Tell me how people, particularly in Ontario, are dealing with this news, because I gather that's where most of the cases are concentrated.
Yes, I think Canadians in Ontario are different from Canadians in the rest of the country. Here, people are quite worried about it. It's really the chief topic of conversation, and everybody is taking their own little measures. So a woman that I know wanted to pay for her son's parking downtown when he started his new job yesterday. She didn't want him to take the subway. But what you don't see, it's different from Hong Kong. People are not wearing masks in large numbers. Mm-hmm. I saw a TV crew out in Chinatown yesterday, and they had to wait a long time before they found one person walk by with a mask.
But so, that showed up on the news last night,
yeah,
for sure.
Yeah, of course. But the reality is, no, people aren't wearing masks. But our hospitals are basically closed to visitors, non-essential staff, and any non-essential treatment has been postponed indefinitely, and I'm talking about over 200 hospitals in the province.
Now, you've also been doing some reporting on this, Jan, that some of the response has been a little clumsy, that the screening at the airport's been weak or inconsistent, that hotlines set up aren't able to handle the calls that are coming in.
Yes, that's right, because the health authorities are reacting to what they know today without anticipating, it seems, what might happen in 2 days. And so it seems everything's a little bit behind. For instance, they started to talk about screening outgoing passengers from Toronto, and then people would call me and say, look, I just came in from a 16-day trip to China, and nobody stopped me at the airport. I just waltzed right through. But I think it was interesting listening to Keith Bradshaw in Hong Kong talk, because here we have quarantined lots of people. Anybody who had social contact with a suspected SARS patient has been quarantined. I went to the hospital, the epicenter in Toronto, Scarborough Grace Hospital, trying to report on the SARS story, and I ended up in a voluntary quarantine myself. And so I think they're being much more cautious here than they are in Hong Kong.
Yeah, you wrote about that in the Globe and Mail, actually quoting your own son saying to you, what is this? I'm talking to my mom. I'd like this to be off the record.
Yes, because I came home from work and I said, we're quarantined. Here's your mask. Put it on. And I have to write a story. So, you know, and he started talking and I started typing and he said, don't quote me. And I said, well, you know, I want to write about being quarantined. Actually, I was told to write about it. But I think it's important for people to understand what it's like to suddenly go into your home and make everybody wear masks and I have to eat separately. I thought that was an important story for people. And now more and more people in Ontario are being quarantined.
Jan, just stay with us for half a sec, if you would. I'd like to bring Dr. Art Reingold into the conversation. He's head of the Division of Public Health Biology and Epidemiology at Berkeley School of Public Health. Dr. Reingold, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
We've not actually seen anywhere near the amount of concern or reporting in the United States about SARS. Is that simply related to the fact that there aren't that many cases in this country, or not yet?
Well, at least the newspapers I read here in California and the New York Times certainly have had a steady stream of stories of bringing us up to date. So I think there has been reasonable coverage in the newspapers. I think so far we have not had much in the way of transmission from people coming back from other countries to people here in the United States. But I think there's a high level of concern, certainly by public health officials at the state and local level, as well as at CDC in Atlanta.
Now, I'm going to get a chance later in the program to talk in greater detail with you about what we know about the disease and some of the other details. But in your years of experience with these types of epidemics, is this following any kind of historical model that we've seen before with a meningitis or an influenza or anything that we know of?
Well, I think in some ways it parallels epidemics we've had in some parts of the world, such as sub-Saharan Africa, epidemics of meningitis. But I think what's unique about this is the fact that, A, this is a completely novel infectious agent. We're still unclear about exactly what the various routes of transmission are, mm-hmm. and we really don't have anything terribly good in the way of prevention and control measures yet, except for trying to limit exposure of non-ill people to ill people.
Let me go back to Jan Wong, if I can, Jan, because I know that you were also a correspondent based in China for a period of time. And one of the things that is known about SARS is that it's most likely to have come from Guangdong province in southern China. And yet there's been hardly any attention or news coming out of China as to how many people are affected there. What can you tell us about that?
Well, it seems as though it started in Guangdong province, which is the province closest to Hong Kong in the south of China. It seems that the first cases started showing up there in late November. But China didn't say anything. China didn't say anything for months. And even last week, when I was planning to go myself to Hong Kong and south China, and then I changed my mind. I decided it was way too dangerous.
You're going to Baghdad instead, right?
Yeah, Baghdad was a lot safer. But I called friends and people I knew in China, and I said, so tell me about what's going on with SARS. And they said, oh, we don't have SARS here. And I said, yes, you do have SARS there. And it turns out that there has been quite a strong news blackout. I was talking to a contact this morning in China, and he told me that when the news comes over from Hong Kong television into the south of China, they actually black out the stories about SARS. And so people in China don't have the information. China has not only not told the rest of the world, it hasn't told its own people, but still the underground rumor mill in China is so strong that people are reacting. You can't buy masks now. It's very hard. Herbal medicine sales are going through the roof. And in Canton, which is the provincial capital of Guangdong province, it's called Guangzhou now, the offices are steaming pots of vinegar because they think this will actually clear the air. So there's this general reaction among the people, even as the government is saying very little.
So you're going to stay on top of this story from Toronto?
Yes, I'm trying to report on it through email and telephone, which is a very interesting response, I think, to this new virus that travels by air. I think it's interesting because it traveled so fast by jet plane. On the other hand, the scientists and the medical experts are fighting it even faster because of this email and the internet.
Jan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Jan Wong is a columnist and a senior reporter with the Globe and Mail. And Dr. Rangel, just a quick question. Is it harder for the scientists to deal with this now because of that blackout of news from China?
Well, I think it clearly is a major obstacle to trying to understand where this infectious agent came from. I think the evidence at the moment would suggest that it did, in fact, originate in China. But the fact that outside experts have not been allowed in yet to do any kind of investigation obviously is a major obstacle to learning more about this new disease.
All right. And Connection listeners, we will be learning more about this disease when we come back after the break with Dr. Art Rheingold. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. In your view, is this country well prepared to deal with an outbreak of something like SARS or something that's similar? 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. You're listening to The Connection from NPR. We're talking about SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, the epidemic that started circulating around the globe last November. With us is Dr. Art Rheingold. He's head of the Division of Public Health Biology and Epidemiology at the Berkeley School of Public Health, has extensive experience working with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention from 79 to 87, and also specializing in epidemiology and the control of infectious diseases in developing countries in West Africa and Asia. Dr. Rheingold, what do we know about this and what don't we know?
Well, I think the best evidence at the moment, as summarized by CDC last Friday, is that this new disease is caused by a virus. It appears to be caused by a coronavirus. And what's quite interesting and unique about this coronavirus is that it's causing this severe illness, including pneumonia. Typically, the two other coronaviruses that infect people produce the common cold. The coronaviruses are one of the major causes of the common cold, and they obviously produce a self-limited illness that never kills people.
So is a coronavirus different from an influenza virus then?
A coronavirus is a member of a different family of viruses,
right.
This is acting, if you will, somewhat more like an influenza virus in its ability to cause serious damage to the lungs and to cause pneumonia.
Why is it that people are as concerned about it as they are? I'm you know, quoting what I read in the medical articles here, that 97% of the people who get it simply get sick and then get better.
Well, I think, first of all, there's still a great deal of work to be done in terms of understanding how this virus is transmitted and what proportion of people become ill and what proportion of people die. You're quite right that at the moment of the people who have SARS, it would appear that the death rate is about 4%. But I would point out that that's primarily among healthy people,
mm-hmm.
Young and middle-aged people, in whom we generally don't expect a fatal outcome from a respiratory infection. Number one. And number two, if this is anything like the other coronaviruses, there certainly is at least the possibility that it spread not only through the respiratory route, but also through inanimate objects in the environment.
Like elevator buttons in an apartment building, which is what Keith was reporting about at the beginning.
Potentially, or through hand-to-hand contact. What we know about most of the viruses that cause common colds is that a substantial part of the spread, in fact, is through you're contaminating your hand through coughing and sneezing,
right.
Shaking someone else's hand, and then they contaminate themselves. So a lot of the transmission of at least related viruses is quite easily done through means other than the airborne route.
Now, the fellow who the WHO has marked as its coordinator for SARS, Dr. Hitoshi Oshitani, was quoted yesterday as saying that he thinks that they're within days or weeks of identifying what's causing SARS, and that'll bring them straight to a cure. Is he being optimistic?
Well, I would take issue with two points there. One is I think that there's already very good evidence that it is, in fact, this coronavirus, although clearly there's more laboratory work to be done in that regard.
Right.
But I think even once we are quite certain that that's the virus, I think we may be very, very far away from effective either treatments in the form of antivirals or a vaccine.
Let's widen it up to bring in our calls. Our number is 1-800-423-8255. First to Boxborough, Massachusetts, and Ken's joining us. Ken, hi.
Hi, how you doing?
I'm fine. Thanks for calling.
My question is this. I'm a science fiction writer, and my mind tends to run in these directions, but given the world condition, at any rate, my question is this. Is there any possibility that this germ was bioengineered in a lab and accidentally released?
Or intentionally released.
Or, well, intentionally.
That's a good. I mean, you know, lots of people ask about the germ warfare side of this. Dr. Reingold, what can we say about it?
Well, I would say that we don't know. My own personal view is that we probably don't have scientists who are smart enough to invent this virus. But that could be incorrect. I think the quick answer is we really don't know. I would say one thing that's perhaps slightly ironic is that the one of the very first cases, if not the first case, in the hotel in Hong Kong where there are a number of cases on the ninth floor was, in fact, in room 911.
Okay. We'll just leave that there for those people who take note of these things. Ken, thanks for your call. 1-800-423-8255. To Arlington now in Massachusetts, and Patty's with us. Hi, Patty.
Hi there.
Go ahead.
Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
My question is, with something that is seemingly spreading very easily and very quickly, what steps could we take here in the United States with a fair amount of cases having already shown up to stop, you know, the spread of this? I've heard so many reports of it being in the United States, but not where.
Right. Okay, Patty, actually, we have David Ozanoff on the line with us. He's director of the program in public health preparedness at the School of Public Health in Boston University and might be the best person to talk a little bit about what the measure of preparedness is in the United States. Hi, David.
Hi.
What have you got to say to Patty in terms of preparations in the U.S.?
Well, I think it's problematic. first of all, as Dr. Reingold said, there's a great deal about this disease that we don't know, particularly its mode of transmission. If you think about what's happening in Hong Kong in this apartment block, if the transmission is vertical, that is to say that it's people on different floors of this building who seem to be getting it, that suggests that it's not face-to-face contact, because social interactions in a building are almost always horizontal. They're not vertical.
So how else could it be transmitted?
One way is through inanimate objects. Another might be through a ventilation system. Possibly through a water system, although I think that's less likely. But, for example, your suggestion of elevator buttons is a very sound one. I think it might explain why there's vertical transmission. But we really don't know. So in the absence of not knowing that, in fact, although I agree with Dr. Reingold, this looks like it's been identified as a coronavirus. Coronaviruses are very common, and there could be a misidentification here as well. The primers haven't been published yet, so we don't really know how this identification was done, and I suspect that in a fast-moving situation like this, there are still some surprises in store for us.
So what's missing in terms of preparation in the United States?
Well, our public health system is in very bad condition. It's in actually worse condition than it was in 9/11, and 9/11 is one reason for that. We've had a real concentration on bioterrorism, as one of the previous questions suggested. That's what everybody thinks of first. But when you think about that tends to direct your attention first to certain kinds of agents, and it also directs your attention to certain kinds of remedies. In fact, what's most likely to be a problem is an episode just like this one, a naturally occurring emerging infectious disease. Although we don't know for sure this is naturally occurring, that's the most logical explanation.
I'm a little bit confused here, David. I thought that there was a fair amount of attention turned to the possibility of having to deal with a smallpox outbreak and that sort of thing. And I would have thought that exercise would have strengthened the public health system, made the system better able to respond to even something like the severe acute respiratory syndrome.
Yes, and in certain ways that's true, it will, except in fact, it's really distorted the priorities tremendously. There's a great deal of public health that's not getting done because of concentration on smallpox. Now, smallpox is just one particular disease, but it has to be handled in a particular kind of a way. And there are people who are spending enormous amounts of time just dealing with the smallpox problem. People in our public health establishments. Mm-hmm. For example, the head of a major public health department in this state told me that he does only two things, smallpox and cuts the budget. Now, his preparation for smallpox includes not necessarily responding to it post-event, but pre-event, or preparing for a post-event scenario. So he's worried about getting a vaccination program started and all the policy issues and handling the money and moving people from other kinds of public health practices, which he can't fund anymore because his budget is being cut, and moving him over into the smallpox side, which he's got federal money for. So it's like the person who exercises his right arm with heavy weights, and it becomes very muscular, and his left arm atrophies. That's what's happening to our public health establishment. In fact, if we were to have thousands of cases now of SARS or any other kind of disease, we don't really have the capacity to give them intensive care, even in our largest cities.
Why?
We don't have enough personnel. We don't have enough hospital beds. Here in Boston, where I'm talking to you from, we routinely turn ambulances away. We divert them from emergency rooms in the summertime because there aren't enough beds.
Hart Reingold, your sense of this country's state of preparation to deal with an outbreak of something like SARS?
Well, I partially agree with what Dr. Ozenoff said. I would say that I think in terms of taking care of sick people, the ability to take care of large numbers of sick people is still somewhat tenuous. That is to say, there is not a lot of excess bed capacity, particularly intensive care unit beds and respirators and things. Most of those are in use on any given day. Mm-hmm. So if you're talking about a flood of thousands and thousands of new severely ill people, whether from an intentional attack or from a naturally occurring disease, there's no question that would tremendously stress the clinical care side of things. I think on the public health side, Again, as was said, some of the things that people are busy doing and a lot of the resources are being used for are highly specific to bioterrorism, such as smallpox vaccination.
Yeah.
At the same time, there certainly are some of the activities and resources that are going to be broadly applicable to any infectious disease problem. I think although there is a lot of money pouring in from the federal government, the reality is because there are simultaneously large cuts going on at the local and state level, there really has been no net increase in public health capacity, and there certainly has been a substantial switching of people from working on things like tuberculosis and sexually transmitted diseases and mental health to working on things like smallpox surveillance and a variety of other bioterrorism-related activities.
So, David, if something were to change in terms of priorities, what needs to be changed? Is it back to the roots of public health and money concentrated there rather than on special things like smallpox?
Well, first of all, we have to recognize that support for public health is diminishing, although it's increasing in certain very specific targeted areas. Overall, it's decreasing in often dramatically, with major layoffs going on in local and state health departments all over this country because of the problems state governments have been in. We do, in fact, we know that there's money for it. I know where there's $500 million that could be put into the public health department of Massachusetts right now, because the president identified it. He identified it with the $26 billion that he was going to give to Turkey, mm-hmm. which now he's not going to give to Turkey. That works out to half a billion dollars per state. If we want to deal with an imminent threat to this country, we would take that money that would have gone to Turkey and put it into real public health infrastructure, not targeted necessarily to infectious disease, but including infectious disease. It included maternal and child health and tuberculosis control and STDs and all the other things. Immunization, which got cut, actually, in this state for the first time, influenza immunization, because there wasn't enough money. That's a disease that we know is going to kill thousands and thousands of people every year, regular as clockwork. And yet, all the money was going into smallpox vaccination, a disease that hasn't been on this earth since 1978. So I think we really need to get our priorities straight. And my concern is that the bioterrorism scenario
has
really
too much of a concentration
that.
All right, David, thanks for being with us.
Sure.
Dr. David Ozenoff is director of the Program in Public Health Preparedness at the School of Public Health at Boston University. And Dr. Art Reingold, you have a view of how all the countries in Asia, how a number of different countries in Asia deal with this. Are there public health systems that are in much better shape and faster at reacting to something like the threat or the concern over this SARS?
Well, I think if you're talking about the countries within Asia, there clearly is enormous variability.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the countries are quite wealthy and well organized, and Hong Kong would certainly be an area where there's a high level of competence and organization. And then there are countries that are probably in the middle of the range, such as Thailand. And then you certainly have countries like Vietnam that are quite poor and have a more limited capacity to deal with infectious disease threats. So I think there's really quite a range of ability to deal with these kinds of problems just within the Asian countries.
And the peculiarities, just to go back, if I can, for a minute to, bring people into the loop on what this disease looks like. I've read that it's, you look first for a high temperature and a dry cough and a shortness of breath. Are those the three things that mark SARS as far as the medical community is concerned as well?
Yes, this illness really looks clinically quite like influenza, although there are other viruses and even bacteria that can cause a similar pattern of illness. But fundamentally, what you're talking about is somebody who develops a fever and a cough, then depending on the individual, may have some other symptoms, will either have a self-limited illness and get better, or can progress to quite a severe life-threatening pneumonia.
Our number is 1-800-423-8255. Let's go to Waltham, Massachusetts now, and Eric's on the line. Hi, Eric.
Hello. Hi. I actually originally from Hong Kong, so
yeah.
This is pretty close to home. I've been calling like family members, try to comfort them about the disease and tell them what to do. I myself is a molecular biologist, so I know a little bit about virus and so on.
Are they pretty worried?
Yeah, I mean, it's all kind of a rumor. They will hear anecdote from China. People are dying in the thousands and all this exaggerated, you know, story that I have no way to confirm or not to confirm. But, I mean, from United States point of view, I mean, you know, from this country, I would say if there's something like this happen, I mean, we should know about it, right? Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I have been just calling them and then tell them, you know, if this is indeed the case, we would know this. So that means it's probably not the case, and just tell them basic way to avoid any virus infection, you know, hand washing, wearing masks, and so on and so forth. Actually, I have a question to your guest, which is very timely, just because we were just talking about the symptom and so on of the SARS. Is it possible at all at this point, even since we don't have a definite diagnosis of what the vector is, all these cases, even in Hong Kong, this one building has like 100 cases. Is it possible that many of them is indeed not the SARS that we know, but in fact it's just a common cold someone have and then getting panic about, and then when they were asked, are you sick? And they say, oh, yes, I am. And are you coughing? Yes, I am. Are you shortness of breath? Yes, I am. Then they will be just become a basket case to throw in the SARS, and now everybody having SARS.
Okay, good question. Dr. Rangel.
Well, first of all, I think the information available on the individuals in that building is still too fragmented to really know whether they have SARS or not. SARS is a clinical definition. At the moment, it does not involve confirmatory laboratory testing, but the CDC is well along in the development of a laboratory test. And once that test is available, it's certainly going to be possible to distinguish people who have an illness caused by this coronavirus, if that's in fact what it is, versus people who have influenza or a variety of other illnesses. So at the moment, epidemiologists and public health people are constrained to using a non-specific case definition, but that will improve quite soon.
Well, Eric puts an interesting point on the whole issue of panic that comes along with something like that. We'll talk a bit further about that when we come back after the break. Our number's 1-800-423-8255, finding out a little bit more about SARS, severe acute respiratory syndrome, this hour. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection from NPR. Listening to The Connection from NPR. My name's Dick Gordon. Our telephone number's 1-800-423-8255. With me on the program, Dr. Art Rheingold. He's head of the Division of Public Health Biology and Epidemiology at the Berkeley School of Public Health. And we're talking about the reports of SARS that we're reading about in other countries. And as Dr. Rheingold points out, also reports about it in this country, though perhaps more limited coverage than in other areas. And Doctor, I want to ask you about the only case that I can recall where I was close to anything like this. I was living in India in 94 when, I don't know if you remember, in the fall of 94, there were reports of some sort of plague in Delhi, and it might be in Bombay, and the schools were closed, and the paper masks sold out, and the airlines refused to go to India. And how do you know when those sorts of measures are the appropriate, the right thing to be done, or some sort of ridiculous overreaction, a panic that Eric was describing he's hearing about in Hong Kong?
Well, you're referring to the plague outbreak in Surat, India.
That's right, yeah.
In that year. And I think it's clear in retrospect that while there were, in fact, some cases of plague in India in Surat at that time, it was a far smaller number of cases than were initially thought likely. But at the same time, because of the enormous reaction in terms of limiting travel, limiting export of goods, there was an estimated $5 to $10 billion reduction in India's gross national product. So I think one can understand the reluctance of countries to make public information about infectious diseases, and that may be in part why China is reluctant to acknowledge the existence of SARS and to permit people in to investigate that, because generally there is a substantial impact on the economies. I think it's very difficult to know at any one point in time what the right level of reaction is and how to not overreact on the one hand or be aggressive enough on the other. And I think that fundamentally people at the World Health Organization, people in individual countries, people at the CDC, obviously on a daily basis are trying to balance the information they have with what they know to be good precautionary public health measures.
1-800-423-TALK is the number to join us. Let's go to Terry, who's called in from Owen, Wisconsin. Hi, Terry.
Hi. I would just like to know where the outbreaks are in the U.S. I know the question was asked a few minutes ago, but I don't think it got answered.
Yeah, that's a good question. All I have are the sort of national statistics that say which countries have a number of cases. Dr. Rangel, do we have any idea whether or not there's any concentration or any particular places in the U.S. where these 60 cases are supposed to be?
Well, for the most part, the cases are in large urban areas, and that such as New York and San Francisco and Los Angeles, and that primarily reflects where people travel to Asia from. So that because the virus has fundamentally been introduced into the United States by people returning here or traveling here from Asia, it's not surprising that most of the cases are in cities that where people would be flying directly from Asia into the United States. So there are, I think, about 20% of the cases, for example, are in various cities here in California. Mm-hmm. Some are in New York. Some are in a variety of other cities.
Okay. Thanks for that. And Terry, thanks for the question to Platteville, Wisconsin now. And John's joining us. Hi, John.
Good morning.
Thank you for your call.
I wanted to relay a personal anecdote. A friend who's a native of Singapore, lived in our town for about 20 years, had some family members scheduled to go back to Singapore in about a week to visit other relatives. They canceled their trip after talking to the family there, who said they would not drive to the airport to meet them. They were staying pretty much in their house.
Right.
And they, if you arrived there by plane, you were not allowed to bring your luggage. It would have to stay at the airport. You were going to be required to take a shower and leave all of your outside clothing there and don new apparel, which had been purchased there at an airport shop, and then any other items, personal items you needed, you'd have to acquire there in the city. And I was just curious if this was typical of what some of these smaller municipalities or government agencies closer to the source there in Asia were doing.
John, do you know if this is actually what the Singapore authorities are asking all people to do, or is this a sort of secondhand word of what's happening to people who are flying into that airport?
Well, I haven't heard it read it in any news media, but this is just what this friend told me, that the reason that these family members canceled a trip they'd been planning for months to go back and visit relatives. It was such a severe restriction that they felt it was too dangerous for them to go.
All right, Rangel.
Well, I think that there are two issues there. One is it in fact a reasonable time to go for non-essential travel to areas where there are large numbers of cases? And CDC and other organizations have recommended that if people don't have an absolute need to travel, that it would be reasonable to postpone those trips until things are under better control. So I think on the one hand, it in fact is reasonable advice to postpone trips of this kind unless they're absolutely essential. I think, and I can't speak specifically to what's being done in the various cities there because I haven't been in any of them in the last few months, but I would guess that there are a variety of different measures being taken, some of which are appropriate and some of which may, in retrospect, turn out to be an overreaction and probably not very useful.
All right. John, thanks for that. 1-800-423-8255 to Montgomery, Vermont, and Ray's with us. Hi, Ray.
Hello. I'm an airline captain, and I've got a quick sort of technical question. The company I work for, we actually have flights in and out of Beijing to Toronto, and I'm wondering if there was an infectious passenger on board, how long would interior surfaces of the aircraft perhaps remain infectious after that passenger has left the aircraft? Say the aircraft lands and there's an infectious passenger who might not even be showing any symptoms. How long would interior surfaces on that aircraft or perhaps the ducting in the aircraft, which can be, can remain quite warm, when the aircraft turns around to, say, do a domestic flight? I'm just wondering, what the possible risk could be to, pilots and flight attendants and other, mm-hmm. other air crew members. when these aircraft are coming in from overseas.
Okay, Dr. Rangel.
Well, I think there are two things to say. First, we do know there has been transmission of this agent on airplanes. What we're not clear on at the moment is what the route of transmission in airplanes was, and there are several possibilities. One is what we would call large droplet spread, where effectively you have to cough directly on someone or sneeze directly on someone. The second possibility is aerosol spread, in which tiny particles are suspended in the air and can travel over larger distances. And then the third possibility would involve either, again, deposition of the virus on a surface, and then someone else touching that surface, or perhaps hand-to-hand contact. And we really don't know which of these is responsible when there has been transmission on airplanes. I think the quick answer to your question specifically is that based on what we know about other coronaviruses, if this one is similar, and if it is in fact the cause of this illness, that these can remain viable on surfaces probably for several hours, not for days. Once they dry out, the virus will be inactivated, but they probably can persist on surfaces for at least several hours.
I know that a large part of the science in trying to determine exactly what this is searching for that distinction, that and you made it, Art, between airborne and, I don't know what the alternative is, fluid-borne virus. If this is something that where the particles are fine enough that they can be airborne, does that dramatically increase the sort of level of concern among the medical community?
Well, I think that, yes, that if in fact this virus can be transmitted over distances through a fine aerosol of small particles, then yes, I think that does increase the risk that we will continue to see transmission.
And Ray, back to you. Do you get to fly with a mask on if you want to or not?
Well, I'm actually off medically for the moment, but I guess that answers my question. My big concern would be that if there are areas in the ducting system that do have moisture in them, almost constantly because of, changes in the humidity level in the aircraft, would that virus possibly remain active in a warm, moist environment for longer than perhaps 2 or 3 hours?
The quick answer is, I don't know, and I'm not sure that anyone can really answer that question for you.
Ray, thanks a lot for your call. Quick to Lexington, Massachusetts now, and Carol's on the line. Hi, Carol.
Hello.
Hi there. You're on.
Hi. I was just in China, in southern China, visiting my son. I was in Guangzhou in the Guangdong province, and I spent a week in Hong Kong 3 weeks ago. And now that I'm home, everyone's terrified of me. I go to get photographs developed, and they know where I've been. And everybody, I know as soon as I leave, everybody washes their hands. I have two questions.
How long have you been back, Carol?
I flew through Hong Kong last Monday.
Okay.
I left Taiwan. And my son lives in Taiwan and Hong Kong and is a model and works all over Southern Asia. How can he protect himself? And when do you think you'll have a test for antibodies? And is this the epidemic epidemiologists have been waiting for since 1918?
Well, your latter question refers to the flu pandemic of 1918, which killed an estimated 20 million people worldwide and still remains largely unexplained in terms of why that happened. I think there clearly in the past 80 or 90 years have been other enormously important infectious diseases that have occupied people like me, including AIDS, among others. So I don't know that people have been waiting for this. People certainly have been anticipating and worried about another pandemic of a serious influenza virus. This is obviously, as far as we know, not that particular problem. As I've said, CDC is well along toward the development of a diagnostic test for this particular coronavirus, and we'll have one available, I think, certainly within the next month or two, at least preliminarily. But I'm not sure that that's going to be terribly helpful in terms of you and your son's problems. I think that in terms of your son's travel throughout Asia, again, to the extent that he can not go to some of the cities that are severely affected, that might be reasonable at this time. Hand washing is probably a reasonable thing to do. And whether or not these surgical masks offer any protection is unclear, but they probably don't harm anyone.
Dr. Reingold, you've worked in that field of sort of international cooperation at this level for a long time. Who do we look to as the lead agency in terms of providing the best information, the most up-to-date information, the best guidance? I know I read a long feature about the World Health Organization saying that, you know, it spent 2 years getting a system of laboratory cooperation and sharing of information into place, and they're feeling pretty good about the fact that they're able to track SARS in the way that they have so far. Is WHO the lead agency here in terms of the people to keep an eye on?
Well, I think anytime there's an epidemic that's affecting multiple countries, WHO has an enormously important coordinating role to play. And I think they have in recent years improved their capacity to do that. And I think that the effective working together by laboratories in a variety of countries, certainly WHO deserves some of the credit for helping coordinate and organize that, and certainly for trying to keep track of numbers across multiple countries. Mm-hmm. I think within the United States, we're also blessed to have the CDC, which is doing a great deal of the important work on this particular outbreak, and certainly is doing a very good job at the moment of communicating regularly to physicians and to the public, providing up-to-date information, not only about what's happening in the United States, but what's happening worldwide.
And I know a lot of people rely on websites for the latest information. The WHO is certainly keeping its up to date, as is the CDC and Connection listeners, by going to our website. We are at theconnection.org. You can find links that'll take you directly to those parts of the website that will give you information that we haven't been able to get through in an hour of talking about it on the radio. Dr. Reingold, thanks so much for being with us.
My pleasure.
Dr. Art Reingold is head of the Division of Public Health Biology and Epidemiology at the Berkeley School of Public Health. Earlier in the program, we talked with Jan Wong, columnist for the Canadian newspaper The Globe and Mail, Keith Bradsher, New York Times bureau chief in Hong Kong, David Ozanoff. He's doctor and director of the program in public health preparedness at the School of Public Health at Boston University. We had help with the program today from Kim Bachari, Darren Minucci, and Brian Myers, and Carl Volker. Our program is produced by Sean Carberry, Sarah Field, Elaine Grant, Gail Harris, Kelly Jones, Marie Kuritsky-Fox, Lindsay Miller, Christina Russo, and Doug Sugertz. Tara Murphy is our senior producer. I'm Dick Gordon. This is The Connection.
To purchase cassettes and CDs of The Connection, please visit www.theconnection.org or phone 1-800-909-9287.